He could make out no faces, no locations, no coordinates. Just a feeling that the thing the sliver had belonged to was determined to survive. The Cinzia, he thought. He was spooling back through the droid factory's history, in reverse. It clearly possessed a rudimentary self-awareness, which shouldn't have come as a surprise, since it had single-handedly organized the surreptitious creation of 4 advanced combat droids without being detected. Even if most of its internal algorithms were automated, it had taken a certain degree of cunning to know when to lay low and when to become active. The flash was probably the explosion that had almost killed it. Shigar wanted to get moving again. The next jump would be the one that would take him home, to where the droid factory had originated. But his eagerness only caused the vision to fray about the edges, and suddenly he was dumped back onto the hard floor of the hold, with nothing to show for the experience. He sat, breathing heavily, and cursing his impatience. When he opened his right hand, the sliver rested on his palm in a growing pool of blood. What had he done this time compared with all the other times before that had worked? He could guess the answer, and it was dismayingly simple. He hadn't done anything special. He'd just done it. The Force had moved through him in exactly the right way, and the knowledge he'd been looking for had come to him. It hadn't taken any particular degree of concentration or any fancy mental footwork. He had done it because he could do it. There was a fair chance he hadn't always been able to do it. He was sure that all those years of training hadn't been for nothing. But at some point, as Lorin had said, all the extra thinking he did on the subject had been wasted. It had, in fact, been counterproductive. The next question was, could he do it again? He didn't need to ask. He didn't want to ask. The time for questions was over. He transferred the sliver to his left hand and squeezed again. A second vision of hyperspace enfolded him, falling faster this time. The blue tunnel was twisted, warped. He felt dizzy. Mysterious forces tugged at him, shook him violently at times. He felt like he was running down a steep mountain and that at any moment he might trip and tumble headlong all the way to the bottom. As the droid factory's journey unspooled backward in time, it took him into a deep, dark place. Shigar didn't question the vision. He let it unfold at its own pace. The shuddering grew worse as he neared the Cinzia's origin, until he felt that he might be torn apart. When it ceased, all was quiet. He felt a sense of homecoming, even though that was surely illusory. The factory was a machine. It had been leaving its homeworld, not arriving there. But the feeling was persuasive. He felt that he belonged here, and that here, wherever here was important and precious, unique. Shigar understood that feeling, even though he'd never felt it for Khifu, his birthplace. Shigar had been a citizen of the galaxy for too long to feel close ties anywhere. Again, he thought of Lorin and her changed circumstances. She too had taken great strides across the Republic and beyond, but now she was stuck on Coruscant, or had been until his arrival. She had never expressed any unhappiness about her relative confinement, but he could only imagine how it must feel. The droid factory felt as though it belonged. Wherever it came from, that was where it had wanted to be, and Lorin had killed it. Perhaps, he thought, that had been a mercy. More voices, this time with blurry faces. Human men and women. Shigar didn't recognize any of them. He made out some words, though, including the Hex's furious catch-cry. It was being chanted by a group of people, including a woman of middle years with short, ashen blonde hair and intelligent eyes. Her hand was raised above her head. She was shaking her fist at the sky. But it wasn't a sky at all. It was a roof. She was in a large space with a tubular tank at its center, filled with red. Shigar didn't fight the vision. He just told it, "I want to be inside her head." And he was. He was enfolded by a turbulent flow of thoughts and sensory impressions. He tumbled, slightly in awe of how easy it had been. Nothing like this had ever happened before. Perhaps there was something special about her, this Lima Zandret. for it was indeed her. He was buffeted by her rage. He found strength in her determination to live unfettered. He grew weary at the understanding that all things must eventually be compromised or die. He felt satisfaction at all her achievements. He wept at the mingled love and loss of a child. Shigar looked through her eyes at the world she had adopted for her own and felt pride tinged with worry and an intense desire for revenge.
"We do not recognize your authority!"
And there it was at last. Everything he had been looking for. The dense metallic world, rich with change and vigor, where no one would have looked for it in a million years. His eyes snapped open. He didn't feel the pain of the cuts to his palms. He had forgotten the various aches and pains of his body earned the hard way on Hutta. He felt only a degree of gratitude that he had never experienced before, blended with a powerful sense of achievement. Climbing to his feet, he hurried to the crew quarters. Lorin was already fast asleep. He thought about waking her to tell her the news, but reined in the impulse. She deserved her rest. He could thank her later. Ula and Jet were in the cockpit. He clambered up the ladder and burst into their conversation.
"I know where it is."
"The world?"
asked Ula, looking up in surprise.
"Yes, I found it."
"Good for you, mate," said Jet. "Got some coordinates for me?"
"Not exactly," Shigar said. "But I can describe it to you. I think it'll be fairly easy to pin down."
"Well, great. I'm very tired of the view here. Take a seat and we'll get started."
Shigar felt his sense of triumph ebb slightly at the thought of what lay ahead of them.
"What?"
asked Ula, staring at his face.
"Is there a problem?"
"You could say that."
Their faces fell in unison as he told them. Finding the planet was one thing. Getting there would be another entirely.
Chapter 26.
Specialist Pedesic looked up as Axe walked into the quarantine bay. The space had been transformed. Large pieces of equipment hovered over the dissection table, connected by thick cables to the bulk cruiser's main processor arrays. The remains of the hex had been splayed out like a delicate tapestry, revealing intricate details of its structure and function. The cell walls that made it robust as well as lightweight were threaded with shining metal, suggesting that they performed key functions as well as providing internal support. She saw several fist-sized globes, like round silver eggs, nestling against more familiar components. The legs had been removed entirely from complex-looking joints and stacked like metal antlers in a transparent steel jar.
"I have much to report, sir,"
the specialist said. She had rolled her sleeves up and her arms were smeared with brown-black goo up to her elbows.
"Then do so."
Axe stood with her hands on her hips at one end of the table. She had been generous. The specialist had had more than an hour. If Darth Kratos had not been so conversational in his discipline, Axe would have come back much sooner.
"Well, the first thing I can tell you is that this thing, whatever it is, isn't finished."
Pedesic selected a slender-tipped tool from the many surrounding her workspace and pointed as she talked.
"See here? Its neuroweb was interrupted before the completion of a full suite of reflex analogs. And here, there's a full array of sensors about to come online down this dorsal region, but it's totally unconnected to the central computer. The reporting system has only grown to here and has yet to join the two."
"You mean it was released too early, before it was ready?"
"There's evidence to suggest that it was continuing to develop after it left the factory that built it. I suggest this thing would have finished itself given time."
Axe remembered how ferociously the thing had fought, and it hadn't even been complete.
"What would the final form have been like?"
"It's impossible to say. The main databank doesn't contain a single template. Instead, there are many, with lots of transitional forms. And there's a biological component, too, that I find very puzzling. This brown stuff must perform some function, otherwise it wouldn't be present in such quantities. Perhaps it acts as a randomizing agent, encouraging it to adapt more fluidly. It's hard to analyze, though, because it's been so severely cooked."
She looked at Axe reproachfully, as though blaming her for the condition of the sample. In this case, Axe was completely innocent.
Either the Jedi or the Mandalorian had done that job for her. And either way, it was irrelevant.
So you've accessed the brain, then?
Yes, just this minute.
How smart was it? Could it fly a ship, for instance?
Not likely, my lord. But if it needed to, it could change itself so it could. Like birds grow new parts of their brains in spring to learn new songs. It's just a matter of...
Axe waved her silent.
Is the data encoded?
Naturally, but the cipher is based on an Imperial system that went out of use 15 years ago.
When Lena Zandret fled the Empire, Axe remembered.
I'll crack it soon. Don't worry, my lord. The fact that the thing was incomplete actually made getting in easier. All I have to do is map the architecture and find my way around.
Axe didn't pay attention to the specifics, and she hadn't been aware that she'd looked worried. If the specialist couldn't do the job, she'd just get another.
All I want to know is where this thing came from,
she said.
And I want to know now.
Specialist Padisic nodded.
Yes, my lord. With your permission, I'll resume my examination.
Axe indicated with a flick of one index finger that the specialist should return to work. While Axe waited, she paced the crowded space, reading raw data and coming to her own conclusions. Nothing she saw contradicted the specialist's opinions, and there was much more to be absorbed than could have been crammed into that short conversation. The globes contained the Hex's primary processors, where sensory data converged, was exchanged, and provoked various environmental responses. The weapons on each hand were little different in principle from standard blaster technology, but remarkably miniaturized and integrated into a limb capable of gripping and supporting weight as well. This Hex had no camouflage system to analyze, and unfortunately the electromirror defense was too badly damaged to reverse engineer. Whole sections of its body had been fried to ash.
I've cracked the code, my lord, said the specialist.
Axe hurried to peer over her shoulder. Scrolling through a holopad was a list of symbols, the blocks from which the Hex's mind and all its actions were built. None of the commands, language rules, and algorithms, however, looked remotely familiar to Axe.
These controlled the Hex? The droid, I mean?
Yes.
Could we use them to control others?
I fear not. These particular commands are generated within the device itself, a unique and purely internal system for coordinating its many parts. Each droid would have a different system, so what we've gained is merely the language for this droid, which is now dead.
All right, but you have translated it in this case.
Yes.
So find me what I'm looking for. Time is short. I have a Mandalorian to beat,
she said silently to herself.
And if I lose, you are going to pay dearly.
The specialist bent low over the section of the Hex she had exposed, remotely operating manipulators capable of tinier measurements than any human could make. Data scrolled dizzyingly in all directions through the holopad, too fast for Axe to follow. Her head soon ached from concentrating too hard on something she didn't really understand.
You have 1 minute, she told the specialist.
My lord, I found it, Padisic said. Name, hyperspace coordinates.
Give them to me.
A sudden upwelling of excitement filled her.
Now! Where are you, mother?
Specialist Padisic rattled off a long string of numbers. Axe closed her eyes, visualizing roughly where the location fit into the galactic disk. It didn't. It was well above the mid-rim, in the middle of nowhere. Axe opened her eyes.
Are you sure that's what's in its head?
Positive, sir. Although it doesn't make sense, does it? There's nothing out there. Nothing at all.
Well, Axe told herself, that wasn't entirely true. There were cold dwarfs and orphaned gas giants and all manner of strange stellar beasts. And it was an undiscovered world, after all, fit for traitorous droid makers on the run from the Sith. It wasn't unreasonable that people desperate to keep their location a secret might have traveled parsecs out of their way to obscure any chance of pursuit. But what had led Lima Zandret to that isolated haven in the first place? What had encouraged her to look in that direction? The odds of her taking a ship on a long jump to nowhere and just happening to arrive at a habitable world were minute.
Run the coordinates through Imperial records,
she told the specialist.
I'm guessing we'll find something in there.
The request went to the ship's databanks. Axe tapped her finger on the dissection table as she waited for the response. It took longer than expected, and she had time enough to observe just how much the baked organic residue looked like dried blood. With a chime, the holopad produced a single line of information.
"Now that really is impossible," said the specialist.
"Try again."
The specialist repeated the procedure from scratch, extracting the embedded data and feeding it into the records. The same result came back.
"It must be a bluff," the specialist said. "A false location to throw us off the scent."
"I don't think so," said Axe. "Everything about it looks wrong, but that tells me we must be right. I told you we'd find something, didn't I?"
"But it's a black hole," said the specialist.
"I know. I can read it with my own eyes."
Axe felt as though that distant dead star had reached out and clutched her with its irresistible gravity. She was absolutely certain that this was where she would find Lima Zandrit, builder of droids who spoke with her own voice.
"I think you'd better give me the name now," she said. "We'll be leaving as soon as the course is plotted."
Part 4. Sabaddon. Chapter 27. It was an unassuming name, Ula thought, as the Auriga fire shook around him, for a colony that shouldn't exist. Sabaddon.
"You know we're insane, don't you?"
Jet said over the sound of the ship's straining hyperdrives.
"If the black hole's mass shadow doesn't tear us to pieces, its gravity will suck us in when we arrive."
"We plotted the course to account for either possibility," said Shigar. "We'll be okay. Probably."
"I'll try not to think about it," said Ula through ground teeth.
"I'm just trying not to throw up," said Lorin.
Ula twisted in his seat to look back at her. She winked.
"How much longer?"
Shigar asked. His calm confidence was infuriating. Ula didn't know how Jet put up with it.
"Somewhere between a minute and never. Most likely the latter."
The ship creaked from nose to tail, as though something had grabbed it at either end and twisted. Ula clutched the arms of his chair and closed his eyes. This wasn't what he had signed up for. Being an informer was supposed to be sitting in the shadows, stealing information, and plotting the odd assassination. It wasn't fighting killer droids, being tortured by Mandalorians, or diving headlong into a black hole. That's what Cypher agents did. A strong hand gripped his elbow. His eyes flickered open.
"Don't worry," said Loren. "We'll make it."
He nodded and forced his hands to release their grip on the chair. Let her think he was reassured, when in fact he was the exact opposite. Shigar's psychometric revelation had raised her faith in him to new heights, although there was a new tension between them now, as though their relationship had fundamentally shifted. That, Ula thought, might be the most galling thing about his situation. Her hand slipped away. Her good hand. The one cut in half by the Sith was encased in a mechanical glove, a paddle-like mitten that enabled her to grip little more. That was the full extent of the Auriga Fire's prosthetic provisions. The ship lurched again. Clunker came forward, swaying and rocking, and ran a cable from his midsection into the main console.
"What's he doing?"
Ula asked. "Sinking his mind to the ship's computer," said Jet past his droid's battered casing.
"You're letting him fly the ship?"
"He's got a good head on his shoulders, and his reaction time's much faster than mine."
As if to disprove Jet's assertion, the Auriga Fire tilted alarmingly to starboard, then whipped back to port. Ula was thrown about in his seat harness, but somehow Clunker managed to stay both upright and plugged in. A moment later, the ship's flight grew calm. The vibrations eased. The complaints from both hyperdrive and hull receded into the background. The knot of tension in Ula's stomach began to unwind.
"Okay," said Jet, punching buttons. "It's coming up now. Hold on."
Ula stiffened again as the warped textures of hyperspace receded. Normally, a speed-stretched vista of stars would take its place. But out here, on the very fringes of the galaxy, they were pointing out into the relative black. Only the faint light of distant stellar islands existed to be warped by the ship's motion. With a gut-roiling wrench, the Auriga Fire returned to real space, and the shaking resumed. Jet shut down the hyperdrives and put the repulsors on full. Ula was pressed into his seat as the ship came about. Sensors swept the sky ahead, revealing vistas unseen by anyone apart from Lima Zandret and her companions in the history of the galaxy. It was much lighter than Ula had expected. That was his first impression. As the ship hove about and the black hole came into view, he saw not a dark absence of light, but two bright yellow jets squirting from either pole of the singularity. That was what remained of the hole's last meal. A dead star, perhaps, or a lonely gas giant that had been unfortunate enough to cross paths with this bottomless monster. As though someone had crammed too much food into their mouth at once, some of the meal squirted back into space, blazing away like celestial torches against the backdrop of the galaxy. The second thing Ula noticed was the galaxy itself. The ship and its passengers were far enough away from the galaxy's inhabited disk that they could see it from the outside. A beautiful spiral with a fat central bulge, it occupied almost half the sky. As it swung into view, Ula forgot his anxieties for a moment and experienced nothing but breathless awe. Every nebula, cluster, and gulf was revealed to him with more clarity and beauty than any map could show. It was hard to believe that something so sublime could be the locus of so much war and grief.
"There's the planet," said Jet, playing his instruments like a maestro.
"Sabaddon? Where?"
Shigar peered out the spectacular vista.
"There,"
Jet indicated the display. Ula could see nothing more than a dot.
"It's farther out than I expected. We'll loop around the hole and catch it on the upswing."
"Is that safe?"
Ula asked.
"Relatively, as long as we don't come too close."
Ula didn't want to ask. Relative to what? Shigar was watching the display.
"No sign of any other ships," he said. "There's a small moon."
"How could it have a moon?"
asked Ketchke from the seat behind Ula.
"How could it be here at all?"
added Loren.
"A black hole will kill you if you come too close," said Shigar. "But not if you're at a safe distance. Things can easily orbit it. Sabaddon, any random piece of junk it snapped up over the years, us."
The way the ship was rattling didn't make Ula feel remotely safe.
"What about heat?"
he asked.
"Those jets are hot, but not that hot."
"As the planet orbits, the hole's gravity will stretch and squeeze it, stopping its core from solidifying. I bet we'll see volcanoes when we get closer. That must be what's bringing all the rare metals to the surface, and carbon dioxide, too, which would also help keep the atmosphere warm."
The jets were getting visibly larger ahead. Clunker remained plugged in. Sabaddon was still invisible to the naked eye, and Ula gave up looking for it. An alarm sounded.
"Ships," said Jet. "Behind us, exactly where we came out."
"Who do they belong to?"
asked Loren.
"Wait till we've gone around. Then I'll be able to tell you."
The display dissolved into static as they fell deeper into the black hole's frighteningly intense magnetic field. A smell of ozone filled the cockpit. Anything containing iron began to vibrate at an annoyingly high pitch. There was no sense of weight because they were free-falling around the hole, using its gravitational pull to launch them out to where the planet was orbiting. Still, Ula felt as though he was being simultaneously stretched and squeezed, just like Shigar had described when talking about the planet. Tidal effects, they were called. His lungs struggled to pull in enough air, and purple spots danced in front of his eyes. Then they were passed, and the pressure began to ease. He sagged back into the chair, sweating heavily and thanking the Emperor he was still alive.
"Right," said Jet. "That's the hard part over. Thanks, Clunker. Sabaddon coming up ahead. We'll make orbital insertion in about a minute. As for those ships..."
He scanned the revived sensor displays.
"I'll count 15, with Republic transponder codes. Stantors must have moved Coruscant itself to get them here this fast."
Shigar nodded. It was clear he, too, was impressed.
"No sign of Striver?"
"That's what the scopes say."
"What about the Empire?"
asked Ula.
"The only ships here are those 15 and us," said Jet.
"How would the Sith know where to come, anyway?"
asked Loren.
"They didn't have the Navicomp."
"They might have thought of something else, like we did,"
said Ula, trying to keep his hopes up, even though he phrased it as a warning.
Best not to underestimate them.
Indeed, Lorin said. There it is, she added, pointing through the forward ports.
Ula craned to see. Sabaddon was a small world, scarred by tectonic activity, just as Shigar had predicted. Its surface ranged from gray basalt to red glowing mantle, exposed to the atmosphere by constant plate motion. The atmosphere was dense enough to breathe, and showed signs of both clouds and precipitation. There were no oceans, just the occasional shining surfaces on the cooler parts of the planet that might have been lakes.
If that's water, Lorin said, the surface could actually be habitable.
Near one of the lakes was a cluster of bright radiation sources, indicating a city of some kind. Elsewhere on the unfolding globe were other bright points, possibly mines or smaller settlements.
Someone's been busy, said Jet. How long have they been here?
We don't know, said Shigar.
I'd guess 20 years, assuming only a small group to start with. The infrastructure is patchy, and there's some places they haven't spread out to yet.
Jet pointed at the view screen as he talked. There were no ships in orbit or satellites. The tiny moon was completely untouched.
Do you want me to hail them? He asked.
No,
Shigar told him.
Wait for Master Shan to arrive. She should be the one to make first contact.
What about Ula?
Asked Lorin.
He's the Republic envoy.
No offense,
said Shigar, turning to speak directly to Ula.
Someone superior to both of us should handle this. I hope you understand.
Completely,
he said with manufactured grace. He would have preferred to bungle a Republic approach to the valuable world in the hope that his enemy's overtures would be repulsed, but there was no way to argue the point without making people suspicious. He would just have to bide his time and hope another opportunity arose. The Auriga Fire slipped neatly into a long polar orbit around Sabaddon, and the ship's engines fell blessedly quiet. Clunker disconnected himself and returned to his place in the corner. It had been hours of racket and mayhem ever since they'd commenced the last jump, and Ula was profoundly glad it was over. Jet clearly shared his sentiments. The smuggler stood up and tapped at the shielding above the instrument panels.
Come on, he muttered. I know it's here somewhere.
A hidden panel popped open, and he slipped a hand inside.
Aha! Those fragging huts didn't find everything, thank goodness.
The hand reappeared in view, holding a slender bottle of golden liquid. Jet cracked the seal and knocked back a swig.
Anyone else for a toast? To making it alive, despite crazy passengers and unreliable directions.
Jet's behavior went largely ignored. For the moment, all eyes were on Master Satil's approaching flotilla. Like Jet, she had chosen to come around the black hole, rather than try to power outward against its considerable pull. The vast forces acting on the ships were much more apparent from the outside. Ula was shocked by the speeds they reached at their closest points to the black hole. One of them failed to make the correct insertion and drifted just a fraction off its course. Instantly, the hole snatched at it, tumbling it end over end into the gaping maw. It disappeared with a scream of X-rays. One by one, the remaining 14 ships came out the other side, shaken but intact.
See if you can raise them yet, said Shigar. Code word, Hawkbat.
We'll do.
Jet capped the bottle and put it away before turning to the comm.
Long-range subspace is scrambled by the singularity, so you can't call home. But we should be able to open short-range transmissions with them in a moment or two.
Weird to think that this all could be over in a few minutes,
said Lorin, as Jet attempted to hail the approaching ships.
I mean, Striver has either lost interest or fallen into the hole. The Empire has no clue where we've gone. Once Master Shan gets in touch with Lima Zandrit, our job is done.
You've forgotten the huts, said Ula. If they have put a homing device on the ship, they'll soon track us down.
Only if they're looking for the signal in the right direction. And who'd think to look up here? It's the perfect hiding place.
Jet had a point, but Ula didn't want to admit it. Once Sabaddon was annexed by the Republic, There was nothing he could do but report the planet's position when he returned to Coruscant, long after the issue of its ownership had been resolved. His mission was on the brink of utter failure, and there didn't seem to be much he could do about it.
"That Mandalorian seemed pretty canny to me,"
chimed in Hetchkey.
"I can't see him falling into a black hole, unless he was pushed."
"I'm of the same mind," said Shigar. "It would be unwise to assume we've seen the last of him."
"Gotta," said Jet, falling back into his seat in satisfaction. "Go ahead, Grandmaster."
"Very good work, Shigar,"
crackled the voice of Satil Shan from the subspace communicator.
"Thank you, Master."
The Padawan was clearly buoyed by the praise.
"The Supreme Commander would like you to return Envoy V.E. to Coruscant as soon as possible."
"With your permission," said Shigar, "we'd like to join the companies you brought with you and observe the negotiations."
"Hang on a minute, mate," said Jet, but Shigar cut him off.
"We've been chasing Lima Zandrit for so long, it seems a shame to come all this way and just turn back."
Ula didn't know what he thought about that prospect. On the one hand, he expected nothing more interesting than very familiar diplomatic wrangling. On the other, he was in no hurry to report his failure to either of his masters.
"I expected that,"
Master Satil replied, with the hint of a smile in her voice.
"Colonel Gurin has command of the fleet. I'll suggest you fall in with Second Company and take the place of the ship we lost. Expect a tactical feed shortly."
"Thank you again, Master,"
Shigar said, surrendering control of the comm to an unhappy Jet Nebula. Already instructions and telemetry were flowing into the Auriga Fire from the approaching ships. When Jet patched his ship's computer into the feed, it would become part of a much larger tactical entity, no longer a free agent.
"Cheer up," said Shigar to Jet with a grin. "You've worked for the Republic before, haven't you?"
"Sure, but only for their money. Not for glory or the fun of it like you seem to."
"It won't be for long. I just want to see this."
"You're not fooling anyone, Shigar. I know you don't want to make good on your deal with T'Sal Barish."
Shigar pulled down the corners of his mouth, but said nothing to deny the charge. The cruiser Master Satil occupied hove past them, a golden lozenge that looked deceptively smaller than it actually was, with a command nacelle protruding like an insect sting from the rear, and a hull studded with turbolaser and ion cannon blasters. By craning his neck, Ula could make out the telemetry streaming into the Auriga Fire. The cruiser was called the Corellia. He recognized its name from Supreme Command Stantor's reports. Jet surrendered his ship to Republic Command. Soon they were just one of eight vessels obeying instructions from Colonel Gurin. The assembly of ships moved smoothly into a lower orbit, juggling course and attitude changes with confident ease. Cheerfully businesslike inter-ship chatter filled the comm, both biological and droid. Clunker's usual blank posture became more attentive. Ula, too, listened closely for valuable intel. In such tense times, military protocols changed almost daily.
"I'm registering activity down below," said Jet. "Zandrit and her people know we're here."
"Why aren't they saying anything, then?"
asked Lorin.
"Perhaps they're shy."
"What kind of activity?"
asked Shigar.
"Heat dumps, mainly. Perhaps reactors firing up. A couple look like industrial sites, but their signatures are off the scale."
"Are you passing the data on to Colonel Gurin?"
"He's seeing exactly what we're seeing. Unless he's admiring the view elsewhere."
The galaxy formed a beautiful pinwheel backdrop as Satil Shan made her first broadcast to the people of Sabaddon.
"My name is Grandmaster Satil Shan,"
she said, broadcasting on all frequencies, since most commonly used bands were clogged by radiation from the black hole.
"I come not in the name of the Republic, but on behalf of the upholders of peace and justice across the galaxy."
"What's that all about?"
asked Hetchkey.
"It's Jedi double talk," said Lorin. "She doesn't want the Sabaddonites to think they're about to be invaded."
"Even though she's riding at the head of a fleet of Republic warships?"
"Even so."
Shigar raised a hand for silence. No one had replied, so Master Satil was trying again.
We have reason to believe that a diplomatic mission sent from Sabaton was intercepted before it could reach its destination. We are not responsible for its destruction, but I wish to convey to you our sincerest regrets, and to share with you the data we have collected regarding this unfortunate incident.
More activity, said Jet. Those hotspots are getting really hot.
Are you sure they're not volcanoes?
Asked Loren. He didn't reply, and neither did the people of Sabaton to Satil Shan's last message.
They could be volcanoes, said Ula,
unwilling to dismiss any suggestion Loren made, even one intended as a joke.
It would make sense to tap into geothermal power on a world like this. If they found a way to store and release that power, that could be what we're seeing here.
Or they could be launch sites, said Jet.
If they're sending up a welcoming party, why wouldn't they say so?
It might not be the sort of welcoming party you're thinking of.
I have come to speak with Lima Zandret,
the Grandmaster tried a third time.
I have reason to believe that she might be your leader.
At last, something broke the silence from the planet. A woman's voice came over the airwaves, crackling faintly with interference.
We have no leader.
Very well, said Master Satil. But am I speaking to Lima now?
We ask only to be left alone.
You have nothing to fear from us, I swear it. We have come to talk and to offer you protection if you need it. You are under no obligation to offer anything in return.
We do not recognize your authority.
Ula's skin crawled.
That's what the hexes said. She sounds just like them.
Shigar was nodding.
This must be Zandret. The hexes share her voice and her philosophies because she was the one who made them.
We have no wish to impose any kind of authority upon you, Master Satil was saying.
We ask only to be left alone,
Zandret repeated.
Those hot spots are about ready to erupt, said Jet in ominous tones.
Give me the comm, Shigar said. Master, I don't think talking is going to work. She's as stubborn as her droids. I suggest finding another approach.
The Grand Master was already talking.
Perhaps I could speak with you face to face. That might help us reach an understanding. Just me and my Padawan, in a place of your choosing. The last thing I want is for you or your leaders to feel threatened or intimidated.
We have no leader,
Zandret shouted.
We do not recognize your authority!
Here it comes,
said Jet, calling up in the viewscreen several bright flashes from the surface of the world.
They look like missiles to anyone else?
Ula peered closely at the image. His knowledge of military hardware was patchy, but the rapidly rising dots did have a lethal air. For a start, they moved quickly, accelerating many times faster than most crewed ships would risk in atmosphere. There were eight of them, long and sleek. They spiraled like fireworks as they rose, presenting a much more difficult target to the ships above. The Auriga fire lurched underneath him, responding to telemetry from the Corellia. As one, all 15 ships changed course in response to the rising threat.
There's your answer, said Lorin. Someone is definitely taking this seriously.
Fine, said Jet, but I'm not slaving my ship to anyone while it's under fire.
Wait,
said Shigar, but it was too late. Jet had already broken the short-lived connection between his ship and those of the Republic. With a flash of its repulsors, the Auriga fire peeled away from Second Company and accelerated to a higher orbit. Behind them, the ships of the Republic adopted battle formation, with the Corellia in the center and support vessels in a crisp tetrahedron around it. While fighters launched from hangar decks, its cannons trained on the approaching targets. The Grand Master said nothing, and the usual interfleet chatter ceased.
Fall in line, Auriga fire!
Came a terse request from the Corellia.
Fall in line!
Jet ignored it, but kept the tactical feed open.
This doesn't make any sense, said Ula, thinking out loud. If Zandret wants to stay isolated so badly, why would she want to talk to the Mandalorians? I'd have thought that's exactly the wrong thing to do.
Maybe the Cynzia didn't represent everyone here, Lorin said. Maybe the people who blew themselves up were a dissident group.
And why attack rather than talk?
He asked, moving on to his next point of puzzlement.
Firing without provocation is madness.
Without a doubt, said Shigar. They practically signed their own death warrant.
The missiles roared out of the upper atmosphere and hit the first wave of defensive fire. A dense net of turbolaser pulses and ion torpedoes converged on the 8 missiles. The nose of each missile activated a defensive shield, not dissimilar to the one seen on a much smaller scale on Hutta. Mirror bright, they reflected laser pulses perfectly, and even deflected a large number of torpedoes. The space between the Corellia and the planet below was suddenly full of explosions. Out of that stew of hot gases, only 6 missiles emerged. The debris of the 2 that had been hit tumbled on, following their final momentum. Tiny white dots gleamed in the light of the black hole's jets. The 6 missiles hit another wave of defensive fire. The shields flashed again, blinking on and off in rapid succession. To conserve power, Ula assumed. The missiles weren't large. They couldn't defend themselves forever against this kind of assault. But they didn't have to. 4 of the original 8 were now close enough to the capital ships to be an imminent threat. Fighters engaged, strafing the missiles from all directions at once. The shields couldn't cover every possible approach. 3 missiles faltered, their drive systems crippled, and their sides spewing clouds of debris. The last thundered on, aimed squarely at the Corellia. The look on Shigar's face was painful to see. His master was aboard that ship, and a missile of that size was bound to do considerable damage, perhaps even destroy the Corellia outright. Ula wondered if she was hurrying for an escape pod at that very moment, hoping to outrun her fate. The missile survived the final wave of defensive fire and struck the Corellia just forward of its star drive. Ula winced automatically, expecting a giant explosion. None came. The missile hit the golden hull with enough force to tear a hole right through it, but instead simply vanished inside. A blast of air and other gases roared out of the hole. No fire. The missile didn't blow up. Fleet comms rose up again, betraying a slightly frantic note. Colonel Gurin was on the air, reassuring everyone that the cruiser was intact. There were no more launches visible from the ground. The attack from Sabaton appeared to have completely fizzled. The clouds of debris from the 7 fallen missiles, still rising under their own momentum, began to arrive. Some of it was scraps of torn hulls and engines. Much consisted of the same white dots Ula had glimpsed earlier. They sparkled like snowflakes in sunlight, drifting around the Republic ships in undirected streams.
"Can we get a closer look at that stuff?" he asked. "If the missiles weren't packed with explosives, maybe they weren't missiles at all."
Jet complied, focusing the ship's sensors on a nearby patch. The white dots resolved into blobs, swimming like amoebas against the black sky. "I'll see if I can increase the resolution," he said. The view crystallized. The blobs became hexagonal objects, waving 6 slender legs. Ula felt a wave of alarm. Hexes. Thousands upon thousands of hexes.
"Get us away from them," said Shigar. "Put me through to Colonel Gurin."
The view shifted to show one of the Republic attack vessels. The hexes were thicker there. Where the hexes encountered one another, they linked arms and bodies to form larger objects. Long strings, nets, or clumpy balls. The cruiser drifted among them, blissfully unaware, even as the drifting hexes found purchase on its hull.
"Get those ships out of there!" Shigar shouted into the subspace communicator. "They're in terrible danger!"
The reply was crackling and intermittent.
"Ference, please, repeat your message!"
Behind his voice was the shrieking of alarms. Ula peered past Shigar to where the Corellia hung against the globe of the planet. Red fire now licked at the rents left by the missile. On Hutta, 4 hexes had almost beaten a Jedi, a Sith, and a Mandalorian. Over Sabaton, a missile's entire payload of hexes had been released into the body of a cruiser. You could only imagine what kind of damage such droids were causing in their hundreds among ordinary troops.
"Forget the Corellia," said Jet. "We have to warn the others."
He switched the comm to general broadcast.
This is the Auriga Flyer. You are under attack. Use your fighters and gun emplacements to clear your hull. Then break orbit and head for clear space. The missiles contain the hexes we saw on Hutter. They'll rip you apart if you don't get clear of them.
Tell them to ignore all orders from the Corellia, said Ula. If the network is compromised, the hexes could sow misinformation, or worse.
Jet took up the advice and passed it on to the other ships. Only then did Ula kick himself for helping the Republic. But he couldn't sit by and watch thousands of people die. The Republic had won the race. There was no advantage to be gained by assisting a slaughter. A blast of powerful static drowned out all communications for a second. Then a new voice spoke from the Corellia.
We do not recognize your authority!
That's the Hexes speaking, said Lorin. They've taken control.
The Corellia's launching escape pods, said Chigar, pointing. We have to get in closer. The pods will be able to dodge the Hexes better than the big ships, but they need somewhere to rendezvous. We can give them that until someone else arrives.
All right, said Jet, tight-lipped. I want you and Lorin on the trilasers, keeping our path clear. If just one of those things gets in here, we're all dead.
Chigar rose from his seat and vanished with Lorin back into the ship.
Ula, up here, said Jet, waving at the empty co-pilot seat. Hetchki, you'll be on tractor control. Clunker, stop the signals of the Corellia messing with our systems.
The droid came forward to jack himself into the ship's computer again. As Ula changed seats, he noticed a bright flashing light on the instrument panel in front of Jet.
Is that important?
Maybe. But it's one thing we don't have time to worry about right now.
Jet punched buttons in fast sequence across the instrument panel.
We have more company.
Ula adjusted his view screen so it pointed back at the black hole. By the light of the jets, he made out a string of ships emerging from hyperspace. A large cruiser and numerous smaller vessels strung out in two precise lines. He recognized their configuration immediately, and a surge of surprise swept through him.
Imperial ships.
But how?
Stryver had the Navicomp. They must have tracked him down and taken it from him. That would explain why there was no sign of the Mandalorian in the system. Adrenaline made his heart pound harder and faster. Yes, it made sense. More than how they had gotten here, though, their very presence meant that there was still hope for an Imperial victory. With the Republic forces in such disarray, it would be easy to swoop in and overwhelm them. Only with difficulty did he suppress a triumphant grin. Sabaddon would become the Empire's prize after all, and his mission would not have failed. Then he remembered where he was, and all thoughts of victory fell away. The Auriga Fire was helping the Republic. If the Empire beat the Republic, he would be dead. Aghast, he stared at the screen as the Imperial engines fired up their drives and powered into attack.
Chapter 28. Axe gripped the metal rail separating the senior command post from the rest of the bridge. Her knuckles were white. She had never before experienced such turbulence in hyperspace. Pilots sometimes bragged of navigating the singularity-rich Maw and told stories of ships lost there in bizarre circumstances. She'd always thought them likely to be exaggerated. Now, however, battling the influence of just one black hole, she wondered if she had been a bit hasty in her judgment. It hadn't seriously occurred to her that she might be snuffed out of the universe by something as simple as a navigational accident. If this last jump from Secarpus V hadn't been calculated to the greatest degree of precision possible. With an ear-splitting groan, the Paramount burst back into real space. A new kind of force immediately gripped the bulk cruiser, sending its crew rushing about to compensate for it. Axe let go of the rail and stood straight, lest anyone think her weak.
We have arrived at the coordinates, Darth Kratos.
The colonel was as thin as a medical droid, and his expression betrayed as much emotion.
All vessels are accounted for.
Very good, Kalish. Show me where we are.
Images danced around them, projected on massive view screens and holoprojectors around the bridge. The jets of the black hole were the first thing Axe noticed, stabbing like shining blades away from an invisible central point. They looked like narrowed eyes staring back at the galaxy in hatred. From the outside, the galaxy's potential was completely revealed to her. with so many systems under her control, what couldn't she achieve?
We have located a planet,
said the Colonel, relaying a report delivered by one of his many underlings.
We believe it to be the one called Sabaton.
Axe quelled a sudden rush of excitement. She could betray nothing in front of her master. Relief, ambition, hope. The screen shifted. A world torn and twisted by gravitational forces appeared before them, blurred with distance.
My lord, said the Colonel, the most energy-efficient route is around the black hole.
A map appeared in one of the view screens, showing a dotted line looping past the singularity, then rising to meet the planet at apogee.
On your command, I will issue the orders to the fleet captains.
Normally, I prefer the direct approach,
Darth Kratos said, peering through slitted eyelids at the views before him.
What is this I see here?
One long finger picked out a particular view.
Energy spikes. Drive signatures.
The Colonel cast a cold, questioning stare at his bridge staff.
It appears to be a space battle, my lord,
ventured one of them, standing timorously in the spotlight.
Identify those ships, barked the Colonel. I want to know who sent them.
Yes, sir.
The girl who had spoken sat down and began hammering furiously at her workstation. Axe wondered who could be fighting out there. Stryver had the Navicomp, and she had the only whole Hex remnant. Therefore, it couldn't possibly be the Republic. Could the Mandalore have formed an army so quickly? What could have roused him to unify his people against this strange outpost rather than a more credible enemy?
Republic ship, sir,
called someone from the bridge staff, proving her wrong.
Definitely Republic. And they're taking a hammering, sir. No other visible combatants, but there may have been launches from the ground.
Darth Kratos grinned, and Axe grinned with him. The Republic had made its move and was being rebuffed. How much easier, then, to swoop in as the savior and liberate the planet right into the Emperor's arms.
Take us in, Colonel Kalish,
Darth Kratos said.
Launch all fighters and prepare for battle.
At this distance, our fighters will not be able to break free of the Black Hole's gravitational pull,
Kalish said, smoothly countermanding the order.
The moment it is safe, my lord, I will launch them.
Very well,
hissed the Sith Lord.
That will have to do.
He wasn't used to anything as lowly as physics standing between him and his wishes.
Full power all engines, Kalish ordered the fleet. Lock courses and prepare to engage.
The Imperial fleet came about, straining to reverse the considerable momentum it had already gained just by being in the Black Hole's powerful gravitational field. The Paramount's engines roared and rumbled, casting a bright blue light across those ships coming up in its wake. The lighter cruisers fared better than the massive bulk cruiser and its heavier support vessels. They caught up and began to draw ahead. It soon became abundantly clear that Kalisha's original advice had been sound. Instead of picking up velocity as they whipped around the singularity's event horizon, propelled by freely available gravity, they would struggle to gain every drop of Delta V wrung out of the engines at great expense. Their progress was painfully slow. Axe could feel her master's impatience growing. Redoubled because he knew he could say nothing, threaten no one. This was his decision, and his responsibility alone. The crew worked around him in perfect efficiency and with maximum effort. All knew that Darth Kratos would vent his frustration on the first person to fail him in the slightest possible way. Axe watched the long-range telemetry closely, eager to learn anything she could about the planet's forces. What she saw puzzled her deeply. There were no ships apart from those belonging to the Republic. Furthermore, there was no obvious assault being conducted from the ground. It looked like the Republic fleet was fighting nothing at all. Even stranger, the Republic ships appeared to be attacking one another. Half the fleet appeared to be retreating, while the other half either did nothing or actively impeded the rest. As she watched, one small cruiser suddenly switched its drives to full, propelling it wildly into another ship, disintegrating both. It was as though something had infected half the fleet, driving it mad. Darth Kratos studied the same data with a deeply suspicious expression. Axe wondered if he thought it was a trap. But to what end?
The Republic couldn't possibly benefit from the destruction of its own ships.
Would you like me to hail either party?
The Colonel asked.
No,
said Axe. Darth Kratos and Kalish both turned to her in surprise.
Master, I advise against explicitly identifying us as servants of the Emperor, she said. Remember that we are the enemy in Lima Zandrit's eyes.
Perhaps the traitorous Heridian will change her mind, said Darth Kratos, now that these weak-willed fools have found her.
With a blinding flash, the Republic's capital ship exploded, casting debris in all directions. Axe shielded her eyes against the glare.
They're certainly not putting up much of a fight, she said.
Half the Republic ships had been destroyed or crippled. The rest were regrouping and recalling their fighters.
Regardless, the situation is clear. Sabaddon is no longer a secret. Zandrit must choose to bow to the Emperor's will or face the consequences.
She'll never agree to her own execution.
Darth Kratos studied her with cold eyes.
Naturally, I will see nothing of the fate in store for her. Cease your questioning of my orders. Colonel Kalish, announce our presence to the citizens of Sabaddon and advise them that we will be taking possession of their world once we have cleared the skies of this Republic rebel.
Yes, my lord.
Axe went back to studying the viewscreens. The firing pattern of the Republic ships looked wrong to her, although she couldn't quite put a finger on what disturbed her about it. Still no launches from the ground, although infrared showed numerous sites of activity. Cities and factories, Axe assumed, that would be bombed for certain if Zandrit resisted. Axe's instincts told her that victory wasn't going to come as easily as an announcement of the Empire's intent to annex the world. But at the same time, she couldn't see how a small, ground-based civilization could hope to prevail against the high ground of space. Even if they did have a mysterious weapon that drove ships and their crews crazy. The Republic forces must have been taken by surprise, so she was forced to assume. Colonel Kalish would be sure not to make the same mistakes they had. No response came from the ground to the Paramount's hail. Apart from garbled transmissions on Republic frequencies, the bands were empty.
They ignore us, said Darth Kratos, at their peril.
Launching fighters in 2 minutes, my lord, said Kalish.
Axe was already heading for the exit from the bridge.
Ready my interceptor, she called behind her. I'm going to take a closer look.
It took her a minute to descend from the bridge to the hangar deck, but it felt like forever. Her Mark VII advanced interceptor had been shipped from Dromund Kos with the rest of Darth Kratos' materiel, and kept fully fueled in case a fast launch was required. The ground crew had it warming up and ready for her by the time she got there. Its familiar jutting vanes reassured her in a way that no amount of deceptive diplomacy could. Forgoing a full flight suit, she slipped a helmet over her dreadlocks, climbed aboard, and activated the internal navicomp. It showed her the projected course of the many wings about to launch around her. She switched that off and mapped out her own trajectory. The hangar crews retreated as fighters began to stream out of the cruiser. The launches were clean and well-timed, despite their pilots' eagerness to engage. Axe slipped into their formation with ease, a sleek black predator surrounded by willing but lesser packmates. She listened to the comms as she monitored the fleet's disposition, but didn't respond. Wave after wave of angular black ISF interceptors streamed away from the Paramount and its ancillary vessels. They were easily a match for the XA-8 and PT-7 starfighters the Republic had launched. Ship-mounted cannons selected targets and prepared to fire on the Republic craft. The range was slightly long, but the still stately pace of the capital ships ensured a solid base to fire from. A lucky shot or two wasn't impossible. Ahead, the vast field of wreckage left by the destruction of the main Republic cruiser was spreading at speed. Only as she neared it did Axe realize what had troubled her about the Republic ship's behavior. The surviving ships were firing into the cloud, not at their own renegade vessels. She peeled away from the wing she had been shadowing and headed directly for the cloud.
Your primary targets are the damaged vessels,
came the orders from the Paramount.
Enemy fighters secondary. We will engage the rest. Fire at will.
The sky lit up as a smaller Republic ship exploded. Against that cruel light were silhouetted thousands of floating objects, suspended in space. Some were spinning circles. Others were edge-on lines. All were instantly recognizable as hexes. The droids Axe had fought on Hutta. The regular hexagonal bodies